You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 3rd of October 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London, with me, Clemency Burton-Hill, and Georgina Godwin.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we set the day's agenda with Geoffrey Kaufman, ABC's London correspondent. Geoffrey, what are we looking at today?
We're looking at a bit of brinksmanship in Washington. Who will blink first, the Democrats or the Republicans?
Also, Marcus Chown will be joining us, or it's possible, if he's correct about us all living in a giant hologram, that it may only appear that he's joining us. Either way, he'll be talking about his great new book, What a Wonderful World, One Man's Attempt to Explain the Big Stuff.
We'll look at how a car named after a Serbian and designed in America has become the most successful vehicle for sale in Norway. Electric cars have stormed the market, and we'll find out why.
If you could pick a car that essentially has the same capacity and has actually way better miles per gallon, then you would probably pick the electric option.
We also see how the city of Nablus on the West Bank is trying to reinvent itself while under Israeli military occupation.
It's not a boom, but there is a lot of change in our social, political and economic life. People generally have acquired the consumption mentality.
All that, plus we play some music too. All to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
It's 1 minute past eight here in the studio in London. As you've heard, we've got a packed show coming up. But first of all, let's catch up on the headlines from around the world with Paul Osborne.
President Obama has warned the US government shutdown could lead to an even deeper crisis. He met congressional leaders late on Wednesday, but they made no progress on the row over the US budget. Some Republicans have said they will only agree a new budget if Mr. Obama agrees to delay his health care reforms. But the president told the American TV network CNBC that's not going to happen.
I am exasperated with the idea that unless I say to 20 million people, you can't have health insurance, these folks will not reopen the government. That is irresponsible.
Mr. Obama says if the crisis is not resolved by the middle of this month, the U.S. government could run out of money to pay its bills. But the Republican Speaker of the House of Representatives, John Boehner, says all sides must negotiate a solution to the row. A suicide bomb attack on a militant compound in a remote part of Pakistan is believed to have killed at least 12 people. It targeted a Taliban commander close to the border with Afghanistan. Meanwhile, India says it's battling up to 40 militants who have crossed the disputed border with Pakistan in Kashmir. Generals say the fighting has been going on now for more than a week. Nirmala Sitharaman speaks for India's main opposition party.
This is a big shame that when the Indian government and the Prime Minister in particular was in talking with Pakistani Prime Minister about peace in the region, here is a forceful occupation of what is essentially an Indian territory.
The leader of Greece's far-right Golden Dawn Party has been sent to jail to await trial on charges of belonging to a criminal group. Nikolaos Michaliakos denies the allegations. He was arrested alongside other members of his party at the weekend after the killing of a left-wing activist, which was blamed on Golden Dawn. At least 40 people have been injured in clashes between riot police and protesters in Mexico City. It happened during demonstrations to mark the anniversary of a massacre of student protesters in the late 1960s. Protesters threw firebombs and rocks at police. At least 20 officers are among those injured. Almost 50 years after joining the Commonwealth, the Gambia has announced it's to leave the organization. No formal reason has been given, but officials have called it a neo-colonial institution. Gambia's president, Yahya Jammeh, has accused the UK of backing his opponents. The UK, in turn, has criticized Gambia's human rights record. The family of Michael Jackson has lost a claim for damages from the promoters of the singer's last tour. They accused AEG Live of negligence in hiring the doctor who killed him. Conrad Murray administered an overdose of anesthetic, but jurors ruled he was fit to practice. Kevin Smith sat on the jury.
Michael Jackson was pretty used to getting his own way. He was a big star. He had all these doctors who wanted to be his doctor, and he could pretty much get what he wanted. And if anybody said no, well, they were out of the mix, and he'd find somebody else.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much to Paul Osborne. He'll be back at the bottom of the hour to update those headlines for us. Well, it's 14.05 in Bangkok, 11.05 in Moscow and 8.05am here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
You're with Midori House, live from Studio One here in London, and it's time now to set the day's news agenda. Joining us in the studio is Geoffrey Kaufman, ABC's London correspondent. Welcome to the show, Geoffrey. Wonderful to see you, as always. Should we start with the US?
Because I think we have to start with the US. I mean, nothing less than the world economy really hinges on what's going on there. So, yeah, it kind of merits a little scrutiny here.
Although I was amazed to see that it's not the front page story on most of the papers today.
Well, it's a little dull, let's face it, but it's serious. And it's not going to go away until it's resolved. So I think you're right. It's not on the front page, but it is really serious right now. We have this brinksmanship going on. You know, we as journalists like to say, on the one hand, on the other hand, and it's the Republicans, it's the Democrats, or it's the Tories, it's the Labour Party. In this case, these kind of moral equivalencies don't work. You know, it really is a rump of the Republican Party, this far right group, based in the core of what we call the Tea Party, that is saying, we have a few marbles and we are going to use them to hijack, or, well, there's a really bad metaphor I just used there. I'm sorry. I apologize to all viewers at this hour. I work in television. Thank you. That's right. Look closely. But we are going to use the small amount of power we have to try to control the government. I mean, they are refusing to approve the new an extension of the budget and a raising of the debt ceiling because they want to use that as a ransom to make Obama delay his Affordable Health Care Act, the so-called Obamacare. Now, that act was passed by Congress, signed by President, and ratified by the Supreme Court. I mean, by any count, that is a democratic process working the way it should.
Well, exactly. It's not only a rejection of the law, but it's a rejection, surely, of the process that produced it.
Well, that really is what's at stake here. I mean, this small group of very hard right Republicans simply they say if we can't win, then no one wins, and they seem intent on bringing down Obama in some form. And clearly they're saying it's just a 1 year delay in Obamacare. But let's be clear, yeah. they just want to see it. They just think that universal health care in America is a communist plot. And they are going to do anything they can. Obama had a meeting last night with leaders of both parties from the House and from the Senate. It got nowhere. Obama seems to, though, have the upper hand. Business is very worried. October 17th triggers a really big day financially when the U.S. would default on its debt and would have huge economic repercussions.
And that is really unprecedented, isn't it? Because we've seen a shutdown in the past. It's not common. But in terms of bluffing their way towards an actual default on the debt, that could have such
cataclysmic. Yeah.
I mean, cataclysmic as the world across the globe, as you say, because although we talk about, you know, Americans' economic power sort of dwindling, actually, this just shows how dependent we all are still on the U.S. global economy.
And for people who don't follow the very complicated American political system, one of the reasons this is happening is gerrymandering. Which is a system of redesigning congressional districts so that your party wins all the time. And what's happened is that you have about 140 Democrat, but more than 180 Republican districts out of 438 that are always going to vote for their person. And that means essentially that you have 180 Republicans who never have to be held accountable because the lines have been drawn, essentially separating, I should say, whites from Hispanics and blacks by this abusive process. And it means that you've got this very large group in both parties, but much, much larger in the Republican Party, who simply can do what they want. And they don't have to face the wrath of their voters because they know that they have a conservative constituency that will put them back in. And so the notion of, well, if I misbehave, I'll get booted out is gone. And that allows them to take these absurd and extreme positions.
Let's talk about the voters for a minute, because according to various American television channels, a lot of people think that Obamacare and the Affordable Health Care Act are completely separate things and have very visceral reactions to both, depending on which side of the fence they stand.
Well, I mean,
it seems extraordinary.
Let me try to be polite.
They also think it's
here.
A communist plot to take over America.
Right. So. I mean, you know, we were talking about
it. And often it's the poorest people who need it the most who are most against it.
I mean, this is a country, you know, where creationism and Darwin are still being debated. You know, they're There is a degree of believing what you want to believe that's going on here. But, you know, the Republicans will say, well, people don't want, the American people don't want Obamacare. Obama got reelected after all of this happened. There just isn't an argument. I mean, you know, as I say, we as journalists don't like to say one side's right, the other side's wrong. But I think you can also get caught in the trap in journalism of saying, well, it's a bit of him, it's a bit of him. And I think in this case, it simply isn't.
Well, Democrat Henry Reid believes that it could cost the Republicans their majority in the midterms. I mean, he says they've lost their minds, have they?
Well, certainly, here's what's happened. John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, who is, I think, a more moderate guy than many of the men and women who are in the Republican caucus in the House, has his job on the line. He really has been trying, if you read between the lines, to find a compromise. But he's got this far right rump saying, we're not moving, and he will lose his job if he doesn't keep them happy. And so it really is an interesting play for the Republican Party.
Jeffrey, we're going to have to move on, because although we could talk about this all day, and I'm sure we'll be talking about it every day until October the 17th.
This next story is terrific, though.
So FIFA's 2022 World Cup decision about whether Qatar will be hosting in the summer or the winter is going to be put back. And meanwhile, this question rumbles on about the question of slavery being used. I mean, it's a huge story.
It is incredible.
It's
and yet again,
The
Guardian, which seems to be the best investigative newspaper in the world right now, has broken this story over the last couple of days. And Qatar, looking to make a big splash in the world stage, the people who own Al Jazeera and now the hosts of the biggest sporting event in the history of the Middle East, the 2022 World Cup. I think it's 9 stadiums a new metro system, something like, you know, 500,000 hotel rooms, all being built in anticipation. And what are we finding? That of the 1.2 million guest workers, 380,000 Nepalese, we've seen, according to The Guardian, just this summer, 44 Nepalese workers have died in the process of constructing these facilities.
Now, I believe that figures up to 70.
Well, it depends how you add it up. But the point is that during the construction of the London Olympics, nobody died. And to have 44 deaths is just extraordinary. And The Guardian quotes one, just to give you a sense of what's going on here. The Guardian quotes one Nepalese worker, a man named Bhupendra Mala Tukari, saying that he was hospitalized for 3 months after a truck crushed his leg. He was paid nothing for all that time, was left without adequate medical support, and was forced to take his employer to court to even afford a plane ticket home. I mean, there's just it's just barbaric. And Qatar has very, very piously said none of this can be true. Of course, we treat people well. The evidence simply doesn't back that up. And now FIFA is being pressured by the UN, the International Labour Organization, and by the British government and many others to use its enormous power to say, listen, guys, there has to be a basic level of civility and decency and safety if you're going to go forward in this. They were originally, as you say, they're meeting in Zurich today and tomorrow. And the agenda really was, it's so hot in the Gulf in the summer, maybe we should move the 2022 World Cup
into
the winter.
Which itself was just unbelievable, because it's not like people didn't realize Qatar was hot before
right.
they won the bid. and there was so much question and speculation around the time of why Qatar had won the bid for the summer World Cup.
I've been to these places. I've been to Qatar and Dubai, and it is, you just want to melt like a candle under a heat lamp. It's unbearable. But the problem, of course, moving winning the World Cup is that you have the Championship League and other events that happen.
The knock-on effect,
yes. Right, that you know, much of Europe's soccer or football action happens in the winter. And so it really is complicated. But that's really, interestingly, taken a back seat.
And rightly should in the wake of these
allegations. And Sepp Blatter, the head of FIFA, the International Football Organization, is who is really, let's face it, one of the most powerful men in the world in that incredibly powerful sport, is now in the position of saying to Qatar, listen, guys, clean up your act. This is not just embarrassing, it's totally unacceptable that you are treating people like slaves. And it really does expose it. You know, I wanted to check the Al Jazeera website, actually, before I came on, because Al Jazeera, of course, is the often very, very good network, television network run out of Qatar, to see how they're playing this. I didn't get a chance to, but it would be worth looking to see what they're saying about all of the labor issues in Qatar.
We'll have to move on, sadly.
Jeffrey, let's quickly have a look at the Italian elections. Now, a little bit later on in the programme, we're going to be having a look at newspapers from there. But, of course, Berlusconi, Prime Minister, four times has decided, or it's been decided for him, this is never going to happen again.
There's a lot of kind of Shakespearean storylines going on here today. Yeah. And this has got to be the most...
Brutus.
Really. Yeah. I mean, he... 77 years old, the longest serving Italian prime minister since the Second World War, a man who has gotten away with all sorts of scandals and all sorts of accusations and arrogance and has been impervious. I mean, really, you know, for all that he's done, a kind of Teflon man, we've seen that he is a mere mortal, and he had to accept this huge public climb down yesterday. He had pushed for a no confidence vote and realized he wasn't going to win. He had thought maybe he could force another election. He realized that they're just, even Italian parliamentarians just didn't have the stomach for it. He's, of course, a convicted fraudster now, about to serve a one-year sentence for tax fraud. And he had to simply admit he couldn't do it. And so he, in the end, withdrew his own vote of no confidence and voted in favor of the government of Italy's young prime minister. And that's a big deal. And it's ultimately, you know, you talk about democratic institutions, as we were in the U.S. just a moment ago. It's a good thing for Italy that we're now seeing the country maybe moving towards a little stability after coming out of this incredibly this upheaval of collapse and Eurozone trauma.
If the U.S. shutdown doesn't completely send that back to
you know, we're all going to go down with that one.
Jeffrey, thank you very much indeed for coming on to speak to us. That was Jeffrey Kaufman, ABC's London correspondent.
Coming up, we'll be in Norway, where electric cars are picking up speed.
To report on the world, you need reporters around the world. With Bureau in Hong Kong and Tokyo, New York and Toronto, Zurich and, up next, Istanbul, Monocle 24 has a growing network of editors and correspondents. In Tokyo, Fiona Wilson.
From the Tokyo office, we cover everything from politics and business to architecture and design. We might be reporting on Shinzo Abe's radical economic policies or territorial tensions in the Senkaku Islands, as well as breaking news from around the region.
In Hong Kong, Aisha Spears.
From Monocle's Hong Kong office, we take stock of much of the Asia-Pacific region. We're watching everything from Xi Jinping's changing China to the Southeast Asian economies that are fast becoming hubs for young, creative business.
In New York, Santiago Rodriguez-Tarditi.
From the New York Bureau, we cover the latest in food, travel and hospitality trends while keeping an eye on the business developments and political happenings in the US and the rest of the Americas.
Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Minutes past the hour here in London. Now, they're cheap to run, they play a huge role in reducing carbon emissions, and they're becoming an increasingly visible sight on the streets of cities around the world. But why in particular have the Norwegians adopted electric cars with such fervour? According to the numbers, the car model with the biggest sales in Norway last month was indeed an electric one. Tesla's Model S was top of the new Norwegian auto market. Well, a little earlier, Marcus Hippie spoke to Monocle's transport editor, Tristan McAllister, who was in Norway just last month.
standing on the street, there's sort of a post sort of transatlantic hangover from the jet flight. Standing on the streets, looking around and noticing there were a lot of Teslas around. And I assumed, since Norway is a wealthy country, well known to be a wealthy country, that it made sense that you'd see very nice cars. But then I realized there were quite a few of them. So a friend explained to me what the reasoning was, or at least what the whole sort of drive for the electric car in Norway was, and it had a lot to do with subsidy and the fact that this car, like a car like the Tesla, an electric car that's a luxury performance car in the US or the UK, is often sort of very much higher priced than a comparable car that runs on petrol. But in Norway, the price is actually comparable because it doesn't use petrol, which means that it gets a huge break and lots of incentives in terms of taxes.
Well, given that explanation for why there are so many electric cars in Norway, do you think all this is sustainable?
That's what a lot of people are talking about right now, because you look at a lot of these laws, and you know, Norway isn't the only place in the world to have such laws. I think they're pretty extreme in Norway in terms of comparing it to the rest of the West, but it could be harmful, at least the downside, economically, because the government does get a considerable amount of funds from these sorts of programs. The cost of certain cars in other parts of Europe is half what they are in Norway because of these sorts of fees, and you would think that brings money into the government. It costs around $13,000 to save a ton of carbon emissions with these cars. At least that's what it costs in Norway. On the European market, to buy the right to emit a ton of carbon, it costs €4. So in terms of costs, it doesn't really line up. So it really has more to do with, at this point, keeping the roads clean, keeping less dependence on petrol. But it could end up just being this, well, it's a feel-good, do-the-right-thing sort of thing, and I don't think that's financially feasible.
To give us a better idea of the prices, could you compare the prices of a regular car to an electric car in Norway?
Well, they're not necessarily as sexy as a typical car, but something like the Nissan Leaf. They're more affordable than your typical electric vehicle elsewhere, but the Nissan Leaf in a lot of places is more expensive than, say, something like a Volkswagen Jetta. But the Volkswagen Jetta in the United Kingdom, for instance, costs half of what it costs in Norway, and that cost in Norway is about the same cost as a Nissan Leaf. So if you could pick a car that essentially has the same capacity and has actually way better miles per gallon, then you would probably do that. You'd pick the electric option. So the incentivizing has really, really helped keep these cars in the market in Norway. But you have to wonder, if it were to grow, I'm sure they fund roads, I'm sure they fund public safety stuff with these fees. So if you start to lose these fees, what will it do for the country in terms of the roads?
That was Monocle's transport editor, Tristan McAllister, speaking to Marcus Hippie earlier. And joining us on the line now from Norway is Benjamin Myklebust, who's transport advisor at Zero, the Zero Emissions Resource Organisation. Benjamin, thanks very much for speaking to us this morning. Forgive us for being slightly cynical, but we've heard of all of these tax breaks and all the rest of it, all the perks you get for using an electric car. There must be a lot of genuine environmental concern, though, behind this too.
Yes and no. I think in general there's a kind of a common feeling in Norway that this is a drive towards the future, so to speak. And I think that's the reason behind the incentives too, that we don't really look, or some people do, but we just shouldn't just look at the price per ton of CO2 reduced, because this is part of a transition. I don't think anybody pictures that indefinitely we will have heavy incentives for EVs. It's kind of the beginning of a transition towards a zero-emission transport sector.
Benjamin, tell us more about why you think it's actually made such an impact in Norway, because actually, on the face of it, it seemed like a slightly curious decision for Tesla to take, that they would really focus on expanding in Norway. I mean, Norway is not part of the EU. It's relatively sparsely populated in comparison to other European countries where they might have decided to make headway.
Yeah. Norway is also topographically not ideal for EVs. It's the temperature is very low sometimes, and you have snow and sleet. So yeah, it's a bit surprising. But it is, as the previous speaker was touching on, is that we have heavy subsidies, and normally in other countries, subsidies means handing over cash as like a tax break or something for people who buy EVs. But in Norway, the taxes on conventional fossil fueled cars are very high. So in the store, for instance, when people want to buy a new car, the Volkswagen Golf is slightly more expensive than a Nissan Leaf, and if you look at the five-year total cost of ownership, the Leaf is significantly cheaper. It is important to have those incentives, because there still is a drawback to driving an electric car in terms of range, etc.
And how are they perceived in terms of brand and image, and is there room for improvement there?
Well, the image has changed a lot in the last 2 or 3 years. You have to remember that the incentives that we have had in Norway have been around for quite a few years. And if you look back to 2009, there were about 2,500 EVs on the roads in Norway. So what has really changed is not the incentives, it's the cars that are available. And with the Mitsubishi i-MiEV, people really went and bought that car, and it has further been kind of strengthened that the EV is a nice car with a Nissan Leaf, and of course the Tesla Model S has kind of broken new barriers for EVs and kind of taking some of the edge off the range anxiety ghost, so to speak, too.
Benjamin Myklebust, transport advisor at Zero, the Zero Emissions Resource Organization in Norway. Thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House.
Welcome back to Studio One. This is Midori House. It is 8:26 in London, 9:26 in Budapest, where we head now to speak to our man there, Adam Labor. Welcome to the show, Adam.
Good morning.
Now, Adam, the first piece that you've got for us, you've been looking through the papers there, concerns the quite remarkable language used by the Prime Minister at the Party Congress on Saturday. What did he actually say?
Well, he's been very critical again of the European Union and the banks and the multinationals. And the backstory is that Hungary's had this kind of ongoing dispute with the EU basically ever since his government came to power in 2014, has also brought in an awful lot of taxes against the multinationals, and is really engaged with a war of words and taxes against the banks as well. So what he's doing is rallying the troops before the election, which will probably be in April 2014.
Is he right to assume that there are these massive capitalist interests waiting to take over?
Well, I mean, what he says, a massive capitalist interest waiting to take over, most people would say a small country of, you know, less people live in Hungary than live in London in the globalised economy, should really be welcoming foreign investors and welcoming multinational corporations. Now, obviously, you don't want to surrender the country and hand over full control to, you know, foreign businesses, but, you know, there's a balance between making a welcoming environment for foreign capital, which Hungary desperately needs, and this kind of language. And in fact, what's interesting is that whenever there is a major foreign investment project, you know, such as German car manufacturers have big holdings of factories here, the government sends out press releases kind of trumpeting it, saying that, you know, Hungary is a great place for foreign investment. So we're really seeing two voices here, you know, one, the domestic voice to rally the troops against the evil multinationals. And then the other voice is actually evil multinationals, we'd really like you to come and build a factory here.
And despite that, though, the government's united?
No, the government's absolutely united. The Hungarian government is a one-man show, united behind Viktor Orban. He has no rivals. It doesn't split. Its MPs don't leak. They just do what they're told. They do what they're told so docilely that there's actually going to be a huge reduction in the number of MPs, down to 200 in the next election, after the next election in Parliament, and that was voted through. Same as anything else, whatever Viktor says is what the Fidesz MPs do.
Talking about being told what to do, Adam, the homeless on the streets of Budapest are being ordered off. Tell us more about this law.
Yes, well, the government's had a thing for several months, even longer, trying to pass a law which would allow some sort of penalties and criminal sanctions against homeless people. It doesn't, they say, critics say it criminalizes homelessness. The government says it doesn't actually make it criminal to be homeless. It makes it, you know, a criminal offense if you're homeless, if you're sleeping in certain public places. Now, there's an awful lot of homeless people in Budapest. And it's partly because poverty is rising here. I mean, one recent survey said something like 40% of the population is on or below the poverty line. And there's many people, you know, perhaps particularly older people in their 50s and 60s, who have been long-term unemployed, don't know foreign languages, don't know computer skills, in many ways are almost unemployable, and through tragic personal circumstances end up living on the streets. And the government says there's plenty of hostels for them to go to, the homeless organizations say there aren't enough hostels, and the ones that they go to, I mean, sometimes I chat to homeless people and they say they won't go to a hostel because they're not safe, they get robbed, they get beaten up there, they're very poor environments, they'd rather live outside. So it's an ongoing thing that lots of countries are struggling with poverty and homelessness, but you know, bringing in potential criminal penalties for it, such as big fines. I mean, how are you going to enforce them when these people have no money? You know, and then what are you going to do, put them in prison? I mean, what, it doesn't solve anything. You know, it's kind of flitting around on the margins of a big social issue rather than dealing with the causes.
Adam, finally, let's look at Kappa Day. The war photographer and the co-founder of Magnum has been celebrated on October the 22nd. So tell us what's planned in the city of his birth.
Yes, there's a big new Kappa exhibition at the Hungarian National Museum, and everyone's very proud of Robert Kappa, one of the greatest photographers of the 20th century, and we can expect to see lots of his fantastic pictures there. The museum website unfortunately only has three showing at the moment. Hopefully they'll get some more up there, but even those are really good. You can see his sort of amazing combination of precision and evocative atmosphere, so everyone's very pleased about that.
Adam Labor in Budapest, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
In the next half hour of the programme, there may in fact be an infinite amount of items coming up. It's apparently to do with quantum theory and the fact there are only a finite number of possible histories in the universe, which may be played out an infinite number of times. We'll be asking Marcus Chown to explain all that, only once though, of course. The interview may also exist in a different dimension, and I don't just mean the podcast.
We'll also see how the city of Nablus on the West Bank is trying to reinvent itself while under Israeli military occupation. But first, here's Paul Osborne with the news headlines.
President Obama has warned the United States government could run out of money within 2 weeks unless the row over the budget is resolved. He met congressional leaders late on Wednesday night, but they made no progress. Some Republicans have said they will only agree a new budget if Mr. Obama agrees to delay his health care reform, something he has said will not happen. It's thought 12 people have been killed in a suicide bomb attack on a militant compound in a remote part of Pakistan. It happened in the northwest of the country, close to the border with Afghanistan, targeting a Taliban commander. The leader of the far-right Golden Dawn Party in Greece has been sent to jail, where he'll await trial on charges of belonging to a criminal group. Nikolaos Michaliakos denies the allegations. He was one of six MPs arrested at the weekend after the killing of a left-wing activist was blamed on Golden Dawn. At least 40 people have been injured in clashes between riot police and protesters in Mexico City during demonstrations marking the anniversary of a massacre of student protesters in the late 60s. They threw firebombs and rocks at police during the demo. At least 20 officers are among those who were injured. And the Gambia has announced it's to leave the Commonwealth 48 years after joining the organization. Though it gave no formal reason, officials described it as a neo-colonial institution, and it follows years of rising tension between the governments of the Gambia and the UK. Gambia's presidents accused the government in London of backing his opponents. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much to Paul Osborne, who'll be back at the top of the hour to update those stories for us. Well, the time now is 8:33 in London, and you're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Georgina Godwin, and Clemency Burton-Hill. Now, there's a type of urban activism that doesn't involve a slogan, a sign, a petition, or a protest. It's what happens when residents spot a need and don't rely on City Hall. In this week's episode of The Urbanist, Tom Edwards takes a look at a few places where planning has gone feral, and for this preview, we're in the city of Nablus.
Nablus has long been considered the cradle of Palestinian resistance to Israel's ongoing occupation of the West Bank. One of the world's oldest cities, it saw some of the heaviest fighting of the Second Intifada. But that was, of course, well over a decade ago, and today the city is trying to reinvent itself while still under military occupation. Monocle correspondent Joseph Dana travelled to Nablus to find out how Palestinians are facing the challenges of Nablus and how it's had to become a bit of a city-state to cope.
The rolling hills of the North West Bank, where the mountains emanating from Jerusalem give way to the coastal plains, which lead to Nazareth. Nestled amidst this cornucopia of olive trees and craggy hillsides, the city of Nablus looms confidently, surrounded on all sides by Israeli checkpoints and under the constant gaze of Israeli snipers. Nablus is spoken about with admiration by Palestinians and fear by Israelis. Once the center of resistance to Israeli occupation, the city is starting to transform itself after years of relative quiet.
In 2002 till today, there is a huge difference. Before, it used to be like daily attacks every day, and a curfew, you know, attacks, invasions everywhere, like army, Israeli army.
Mohammed Aish is a Palestinian from the Balata refugee camp, situated at the entrance of Nablus. Having survived two intifadas, or uprisings, he is soon moving away from his hometown to Europe.
And especially for the economical situation, it's a bit different. Socially, life is a bit different too. Because nowadays we have these kind of, you know, rules that they don't want you to be, like, resisting. And in a way, they open for you the social life, like, you know, you can do whatever you want, but don't intervene with anything connected to the political situation. So this is one of the main issues.
During the second intifada, the Israeli military laid siege on Nablus. Palestinian fighters remained largely invisible from an aerial perspective in the labyrinth of narrow streets in Nablus's old city. In order to bring the city under control, the Israeli military began literally walking through walls. An idea gleamed from a close reading of the French philosopher Gilles Deleuze, whose writings challenged traditional concepts of how the individual interacts with the urban environment. Rafi Segal, an Israeli architect who has written extensively about how Israel has used urban planning and architecture to control the Palestinian West Bank, sees Nablus as a test case for Israel's ongoing colonial project of control. I reached him in New York.
In general, the kind of strategies and tactics that Israel has employed in the West Bank have been extremely successful, unfortunately. It can be described as an overall strategy of fragmentation and segregation and separation, which has been executed on all levels of daily life, but also architecturally and urbanistically.
With the cessation of violence of the Second Intifada, Nablus calmed, but not because of the laying down of arms. Having thoroughly destroyed the city, the Israeli military retreated to well-guarded checkpoints at the entrance, and a Palestinian Authority police force was given free rein. Sitting on his expansive deck overlooking Nablus, with clear views to the Mediterranean Sea, Professor Sattar Qasim doesn't see any economic boom in the city. Rather, the quelling of violence in Nablus is emblematic of something deeper in the Palestinian national consciousness.
It's not a boom, but there is a lot of change in our social, political, and economic life. People generally have acquired the consumption mentality. In general, they have lost their patriotic mentality. They care about their own economic welfare. It's very hard to find people who are thinking of Palestine now or about the Palestinian basic national rights. And I consider this a success to Israel and the United States, because that's what they meant by solving the Palestinian question. It's through liquidation, through dissolution. Just get people out of their Palestinian mentality toward their individual mentality.
There's a popular joke on the West Bank that ends with a Palestinian from Ramallah holding the rifle of an Israeli soldier while he searches a man from Nablus. Ramallah, given its proximity to Jerusalem and its role as the seat of the Palestinian Authority's power, is seen in the eyes of many here as having given up the fight against Israel's occupation of the West Bank. Its influence is even seeping into other West Bank cities, like Nablus and Hebron. According to Professor Qasim, this has been the Israeli plan to control Nablus for some time, but it will not last forever.
Well, I think, yeah, to some extent they are happy with the situation, but they are not confident that the situation will continue. Things will change. We have so many good fighters here in Nablus who are ready to face the Israelis, but, you know, with the cooperation of the Palestinian Authority, so many of these people were put in jail, and their guns expropriated. Things are dormant. Things might change. For instance, against the interests of Israel, you will find these groups coming out, coming back.
It is hard to talk about Palestinian urbanism because of the ever-present Israeli occupation, which dictates everything about daily urban life here. When it comes to Nablus, what appears on the surface ungovernable and unruly is actually the way life functions under occupation. Nablus, in this regard, forces us to rethink how cities and conflicts coexist. For Monocle in Nablus, I'm Joseph Dana.
And you can hear more stories like that on this week's edition of The Urbanist that premieres here on Monocle 24 at 1900 hours London time. That's 2200 hours in Moscow and 11 a.m. in Los Angeles.
You're listening to Midori House. Now, Marcus Chown is a fun guy, but so are we all, apparently. One-third mushroom DNA, that is, according to his new book, What a Wonderful World. He'll be here right after this to bring us all up to speed on how we've evolved and how the 21st century really works.
The perfect way to start the day on the East Coast or in Latin America, your lunchtime catch-up in Europe, The Briefing is Monocle 24's fast-paced news and business show, bringing you up to speed with all the day's biggest stories.
It is absolutely vast. It's palatial in its proportions, this building, and it really reflects just how important the role of Mayor of Paris is.
Monocle's team of in-house experts bring you all the latest news on media and aviation, defence and technology, while an editor is on hand to run through the morning's front pages from Bogota to Boston.
You have all these people scrambling, you have all these investigators involved, and we still don't have a clear reason as to why these batteries did what they did.
My feeling is that politicians eat and try to enrich themselves and tax us.
That's The Briefing, every weekday at midday in London and 7 a.m. in New York, in association with BlackBerry.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. The time is 15:41 in Shanghai, 8:41 here in London. Now, Marcus Chown has been called the finest cosmology writer of our day and also sexy and mind-blowing, according to Nature magazine. We can verify that that's true. He's here in the studio, the award-winning author, broadcaster and scientist, currently the cosmology consultant on The New Scientist.
He's written several books about science, and the latest work, which he's here to talk about, it's in fact released today, is What a Wonderful World, One Man's Attempt to Explain Everything. Welcome to Midori House, Marcus.
Hi.
The book's had its genesis in your award-winning app, The Solar System, which I've had a little play with and found it fabulous, really easy to use, very intuitive. But it's a huge leap to make, surely, from explaining the solar system to explaining, well, everything.
It is. I mean, essentially, I'm a popular science writer, but I've got a fantastic editor at my publisher in London called Neil Belton. And he said, well, you have this skill, being able to explain difficult physics to anyone. Why don't you use that skill to explain everything to anyone? How the world works. And I was, completely daunted and tried to put him off for about 2 years. How would I ever start? But you just mentioned solar system for iPad. When I did that, I had to write, I think, 120 stories about planets and moons and things in 9 weeks. And so there was no alternative but just to jump in, start writing and think about the next thing. So in the end, I thought, well, I'll just dive in and I'll write about things that I'll first of all, research things I don't know anything about, like money, cell biology, things like that. Do the hard things first, ring up people, pick their brains. And oh my goodness.
Pick their phones.
And that is a real phone ringing in an actual quantum universe.
Speaking about ringing them up, well, this is somebody phoning to answer an important physics question.
The incredible thing is that I never use a mobile phone because I work from home and I'm freelance and I never use it. And that is probably the first time it's ever rung.
It could be, of course, an alien ringing, but then it could be a human because actually humans are 99.75% alien. That's just one fact we've plucked out from your... Actually, we have to say dizzying array of what you're talking about, the big stuff, as you say. It's everything. You're covering really everything.
Everything from finance to thermodynamics, sex to special relativity, that kind of stuff. I did begin to appreciate what an incredible world we live in, something that we couldn't possibly have invented. And you just mentioned that. Yeah, I mean, about 95% of the cells in our body are alien. You know, they're hitching a ride. They're bacteria, they're fungi, all kinds of stuff. And you just mentioned a figure even higher, and that's 99.75% of the DNA in your body is actually belongs to all these organisms. You know, so you're born 100% human because you don't have any of these foreign gut bacteria or anything when you're born, and you die 99.75% alien.
Which is quite extraordinary. I love the way that you make it so accessible to non-scientific people. For instance, I like that when it comes down to it, we're all, and it all, is just Lego.
Lego, yes. Essentially, absolutely. I mean, we're made of atoms. There are 92 different types, ranging from the lightest, which is hydrogen, up to the heaviest naturally occurring, which is uranium. And yeah, we are just different combinations of those atoms. I mean, what's so fantastic about that idea is that it's an idea of Democritus, 440 BC, didn't know anything about science, picked up a rock or maybe it was a piece of pottery and thought, if I cut this in half and cut the halves in half, can I keep going forever? And he thought, well, no, you know, sooner or later, you're going to get to some indivisible, uncuttable grain. And the Greek for uncuttable is atomos. And so this guy, in 2,500 years ago, comes up with the idea of atoms. And he says, well, there's not just one type, there are multiple types. He didn't know about Lego, of course. And really, beneath the skin of reality, everything's simple. Everything's in the combinations, you know. I mean, and that is what science discovered. We didn't actually even see an atom until 1980. When IBM, two researchers who later got the Nobel Prize, invented something called the scanning tunneling microscope, and they saw atoms, and they were the way Democritus had envisioned them, you know, like tiny footballs, tiny like apples in a or oranges in a box. I mean, if I had a time machine, I'd love to bring him forward, because I mean, that's got to be the biggest.
He'd probably say, "What took you so long? I told you this 2,500 years ago." I mean, it is just, as I say, it's sort of dizzying range here. It must have been the most tremendous fun and fascinating endeavour to research, but as you mentioned, it's probably quite daunting. It's only about 400 pages. I mean, it's a big book, but it's not enormous. I mean, were there moments when you just thought, I can't possibly fit everything into it? You know, well, I mean, how did you even begin to approach it? How did you get all of it into such a kind of readable and compact volume?
I should say it's big print and there's a lot of white space, because I try to write books that are not daunting. I write for my wife, who's a nurse. She hasn't got any science background. I mean, she has a medical background, but she doesn't have a science background. So I try and make it accessible to her. So my whole point although I'm a cosmology consultant for New Scientist, I try and write for everyone. I try and make it non-threatening. How did I start? As I said, I just kind of jumped in and I thought, well, I absolutely know nothing about money. You know, I don't know how the brain works. The big problem was, as a journalist, identifying someone to phone up whose brain I could pick. And this often took quite a while. So I would have done more subjects if I'd had more time, but I had to do it to a deadline of a year. But it was I absolutely enjoyed learning about things that I knew nothing about. And in the end, I did know something about them, sorry.
It's beautifully written too. I love the way that every chapter starts with a quote. You've got a wonderful one on the chapter on evolution from Churchill, talking about pigs, saying, "Pigs look us straight in the eye and see an equal." And Phyllis Diller, of course, on sex. That's a great quote.
That is, yeah. Unfortunately, I can't remember it, but you can.
Well, it was all about sex and the long-distance relationship, I think.
That's right. She lived 40 miles away from her boyfriend. That's right.
Yes. But it's very beautifully written. This is not a science manual.
No. I mean, normally
that science writing can't be beautiful.
No.
I should say.
I mean, normally I try and reach anyone. I mean, I actually changed the life of the wife of a South London taxi driver called Pam, who actually wrote to me when I wrote one of my previous books. And she said she'd been brought to tears reading one of my books. I hope it wasn't, you know, it was so bad. But she was actually inspired. She left school when she was 14. She had no qualifications. She had three boys. She was inspired to go to get A-levels, go to university. And she was a real-life educating Rita. You know, there's a movie called Educating Rita, in which somebody who's underutilized gets inspired and goes to university. So that's really fantastic that it happened.
What was the most amazing or unexpected fact that you uncovered during this year of investigation?
Well, lots of them, but one of them was that the crucial advantage that humans had over Neanderthals may have been sewing. You know, Neanderthals are extinct, we're here. And it's postulated that it was we've never found a Neanderthal needle, but we found bone human needles, that it was the ability to actually make better baby clothes that gave human babies a crucial survival advantage during the Ice Age winters, and that may have actually allowed us to outcompete Neanderthals. Although I should say, 2.5% of your DNA is Neanderthal, so it's not a simple story.
And are we all part of a giant hologram?
That's a very interesting idea, isn't it? But it does appear that our basic theories of physics only require two dimensions, and we live in a three-dimensional universe. So it has been postulated that we are projections in some sense of a hologram. We're all in the universe is actually a hologram, a two-dimensional object.
Wow. Mind-boggling, all of it. And at the end of the book, of course, you say that this is just one man's attempt to explain everything, Volume 1. We very much look forward to Volume 2. Marcus Chown, author of What a Wonderful World, One Man's Attempt to Understand the Big Stuff. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, we probably don't even need to explain what song we're going to play because, of course, Marcus's book is called What a Wonderful World.
What a wonderful world. Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Louis Armstrong and What a Wonderful World. You're listening to Midori House with me, Georgina Godwin and Clemency Burton-Hill. Well, it's time now to leaf through the Italian newspapers with Monocle researcher David Pleasant. What have you seen today, David?
Well,
just a hunch.
Obviously, there's one story dominating all others, and that's the incredible kind of turn of events of yesterday. We heard a little bit earlier in the show from our newspaper reviewer. If we just go into detail how the different papers are taking the U-turn that we saw Berlusconi take, whereby he basically allowed Letta to go through with the vote of confidence. So if we start with La Repubblica, big focus of, or La Corriere della Sera, I should say, the big kind of focus here is the kind of Angelino Alfano, the interior minister, who's been Berlusconi's kind of henchman within the coalition. It's basically, he came out with some fantastic statements as a result of the events. He said that I'm never going to have a knife held to my throat again, meaning what was happening to him, kind of the pressure being put on him by Berlusconi. He's also said, he's quoted as joking to Berlusconi, look at me, I'm the traitor. What are you going to do with me next? So there's this kind of light, almost euphoric mood amongst some of the people involved in what happened. That's Corriere della Sera. There's also a quote from Berlusconi. He told the paper that it was with great difficulty that he wanted everybody to vote for a kind of faith within the government. So, I mean, it's kind of a big turn of events. Interestingly, Il Giornale, that's the Berlusconi's own paper daily, kind of has put the focus on the president, saying quite a cynical piece from Il Giornale, saying that the grandpa of the Republic is now all reigning king. It's kind of a slightly strange piece that you might imagine actually from that paper.
There's a lot of grandiose language like that, a lot of very Shakespearean parallels being drawn. Alfano as Brutus to Berlusconi's Caesar.
Exactly. And it's kind of funny how it's changed so rapidly, the perception of Alfano. He was seen as this very ominous, dark character, and now he's kind of seen as the kind of facilitator. And there's pictures of him and Letta kind of joking. There's one picture of them doing a high five. You know, it's kind of it's a really extraordinary turn of events. But you're right. He has completely changed perceptions very quickly.
The near death of the coalition, just 5 months after it was created, presumably illustrates just the sheer challenge of pursuing quite an ambitious economic overhaul amid such a fragmented and quarrelsome political scene. You know, is there any hope that it can be rescued at this point? Because, I mean, the stakes are incredibly high. And as far as the rest of Europe looks at it, Italy is a much bigger headache than Greece, even though Greece only represents 2% and Italy represents 16%. You know, it's really dire what's going on.
Well, yeah, you're quite right. I mean, and interesting, La Repubblica picks up on this with the rating agency Moody, what they kind of make of the whole situation in terms of the rating of the kind of prospects for the Italian economy. And Moody's made an announcement saying there's less fear of them in the markets as a result of the vote of confidence. But instability is putting a stop on any kind of recovery. And that's kind of the question. I mean, it's still incredibly unstable, the political scene and also the economic kind of recovery. There have been encouraging signs, but this just illustrates just how kind of on the edge things still are.
Well, I mean, economically, are they still on course to achieve the 3% deficit target?
Well, they seem to be just. La Repubblica is saying that there's been a slight rebalancing in terms of the bonds with in comparison to Spain. So it's kind of seen as this marker with the Spanish bonds. If Italian bonds reach the same level as Spanish bonds, that's seen as kind of the real low point within kind of the economic picture. Apparently, they've recovered somewhat, but still compared to German bonds, completely, you know, like at a very low point.
David, I was in Rome over the weekend. I popped over to St. Peter's and saw the Pope rather up close and personal, not because I'm an ardent Catholic, but just because I think I quite like this Pope from what he's been saying recently. He's given a long interview now as well. What has he said?
Yeah, this is it was actually in yesterday's La Repubblica. There was a unprecedentedly long interview with the editor of La Repubblica, and the paper's still kind of, picking extracts from that and kind of deciphering what he said. I mean, it's an incredibly detailed and an informal interview at some point. The editor asks him, did communism ever seduce you? And the Pope says, indeed it did, but he found it too materialistic. Or he talks about the influence of his parents. When did his devotion, was he always kind of devoted to the faith? And he said that the Pope replies, well, actually it happened to him quite late in life. It's a fantastically open interview, although some of it, I mean, it's really kind of dwelling on a kind of theoretical and a theologian kind of debates, but it's a good read.
We're going to have to leave it there, David. Thank you so much for joining us. That is all we have time for today. Thanks to our producers, Marcus Hippie and Barbara Feeney, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Gaia Lutz. Our studio manager was Chris Fitch. Well, the Culture Show is up next after the news with Robert Bound, and Georgina will be back after that with today's Continental Shift.
Stay tuned for the briefing at midday London time. That's 7 a.m. in New York. And don't forget the latest edition on Monocle 24. That's Aperitivo at 1800 hours London time, 1300 in New York City. Both Clemency and I will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.